Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is Wednesday, June 23rd, 2004. Today's session number is FAR 2004-01. Today's speaker is Renita Falkenstern. The lesson for today is Book Discussion, Life of Pi, a novel by Jan Martel. Let's listen in.
Hi. So, my name is Renita Falkenstern, and I'm a campus chaplain in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, just to the north of Montana and North Dakota, and I am a native of Saskatchewan as well. So, I kind of thought it would be a good idea to choose a Canadian author, because it maybe haven't had as much chance to hear about different Canadian authors. So, and this book has won international fame since it's won the 2003 Booker Prize. Before that, Jan Martel wrote a couple of novels, but they didn't get very far. They only sold about 1,000 copies, I think he said, and kind of foundered. Just a few other words about Jan Martel. Most of it you can see on the back if you have a copy of the book. He was born in 1963 to Canadian parents in Spain, so we'll still claim him as a Canadian, though he's not actually born in Canada. But he says he mostly lives in Montreal, except this last year he lived in Saskatoon. He was the author in residence at the library, which he accepted that position before he won the Booker Prize. But then he still agreed to come and spend the year and had a very good year there, giving a number of public presentations and lectures. And actually considering moving to Saskatoon, he and his wife, so I guess it's a well-kept secret. I did get a chance to hear Jan do a reading. He did it for Multifaith Saskatoon, which is an organization that tries to educate people about different religions and also to build bridges between them. And he mostly read for about a half an hour the section talking about his Hindu upbringing, his conversion to Christianity, and then a little bit of his conversion to Islam. Because he, in the Pai Patel in the story, is a practicing Hindu, Christian, and Muslim. And we'll get to that in a minute. I'll give a synopsis of the whole story, because I said in the blurb that you don't have to read the novel to be able to participate. I'm a campus chaplain, and so I know whenever I do a book discussion groups with students, you know, they have a number of pressures, and you just want them there, right? You don't want to load guilt on them. So, and you can usually join the conversation pretty easily once you get the initial drift of the story. But in this presentation that Jan was giving to this religious community in Saskatoon, I didn't take any notes, but I remember, I think, two things that he said that I thought I would share with you that might be of interest to you. The first was that, and a comment really about our educational system. He said that he had gone through university, and it was like he had created these very sophisticated, very well-honed tools, you know, like he had created a hammer, to use that metaphor, but he had absolutely no idea what its purpose was or what it was for. So I think if you spend any time on educational campuses these days, you see a lot of people becoming kind of specialized idiots, right? They've become very adept in one area and maybe don't learn how to do critical thinking. Right? They learn how to consume a huge quantity of information and regurgitate it, whether they want to or not. That's kind of the game they have to play. But maybe you don't get an opportunity to ask the meaning questions or the big questions of life, the meaning of life. And so I think for Jan Martel, this was an opportunity to explore the big questions in his own life. And I think he was going through a crisis in his own life that he needed to do that as well. The other thing is that he wanted to make a comment because he's often been criticized for being syncretistic. Because Pi is a practicing Hindu, Christian, and Muslim, people call him a syncretist, which my understanding means that, you know, you kind of take a little bit of a variety of different religions and you kind of smush them all into one. You take kind of like a smorgasbord approach to spirituality, and you like say, well, I like grace from Christianity, and I like meditation from Zen Buddhism, and I like the approach to the creation and native spirituality, and you just take what you like and kind of leave the rest. But he says, no, that's not what Pai Patel does. He is an adherent of three different religions, and he takes them as a whole, and he practices each of them. So he grows up as a Hindu, he does puja, daily worship in the temple. He meets Jesus Christ on an afternoon on vacation, and he converts to Christianity, is baptized, and is a practicing Christian, reads his Bible, and also becomes a Muslim. Meets a Muslim baker and Sufi mystic, and gets a prayer mat and does his daily prayer 5 times a day. So he claims, at least the author, that that it's different than just a smorgasbord approach to Christian or to religion, but instead is practicing three separate religions as a whole. So I pass that on to you as well. The other thing that I, for those of you who have read the book, that I will mention that I heard secondhand from another lecture that he gave that I didn't attend. If you're wondering about that crazy scene about the LJ Island.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah.
What was that about? He said that he, as a storyteller, he wanted to see how far he could take you.
Yes,
to the outer limits of believability.
Thank you.
Before it would break down. So they're not necessarily having some great symbolism or anything, but just, how far can you weave that yarn before it breaks, I guess. Mm-hmm. And you can be the judge of whether it worked or not. I myself thought that was one of the weaker parts of the book, and I didn't really get what that was all about. Carnivorous islands. Don't quite understand that. So, in order to be able to help more of you be able to kind of enter into the conversation and make sense of the story, I thought it might be helpful to work my way through it. And there's three different parts of the book, and try to describe the main things that happen, and also to touch down at a few points and maybe read a couple of paragraphs here and there to give you some of the flavor and to bring out some of the issues. And you'll be able to get a sense of the style of his writing, which is pretty entertaining, and I think you'll find quite engaging. Okay, so the first part is entitled Toronto and Pondicherry. And Pondicherry is in southern India. Okay, so it begins with the author meeting, first, he's hungry for a story, and he's in India, he's in Pondicherry, and he runs into a man who says, I can tell you a story that will make you believe in God. And he's intrigued, and he's pulled in, and he hears the story about Pai Patel. He goes to Toronto and looks up Pai Patel in the phone book and calls him up. He's about 40 years old, graying hair, and he agrees to meet with the author to tell him his life story. Okay, so we begin then with his story in Pondicherry. And the first time I will step down is when he writes this on his board at school. He's gone to elementary school or primary school, I don't know what you call it here. But he's being teased relentlessly, as you always have happened to you when you're elementary school. People figure out what your weakness is, and they go for it, and they get a nickname that sticks. And so because his first name is Pasing, does it sound like anything to you? So somebody names him Pasing as his nickname. He said, they would say things like, where's Pasing? I've got to go. And so when he gets to high school, before anyone has an opportunity to label him with this nickname, he writes this in every classroom that he goes to. So the first thing he does when his name is called in roll call, he writes down, my name is Pasing Molitar Patel, known to all as Pai Patel. And just so that they have absolutely no chance to forget it, he writes Pai in 3.14. And we can talk later on, too, if you want to speculate about why he's there's any meaning to that pi 3.14 in terms of the story. Okay. He grows up in a very unusual setting. His parents are zookeepers in southern India. And if you can try to imagine what that would be like to have the zoo be your backyard and your playground. I thought I would step down here and give you a little snippet. Before moving to Pondicherry, Father ran a large hotel in Madras. An abiding interest in animals led him to the zoo business. A natural transition, you might think, from hotel keeping to zookeeping. Not so. In many ways, running a zoo is a hotel keeper's worst nightmare. Consider, the guests never leave their rooms. They expect not only lodging, but full board. They receive a constant flow of visitors, some of whom are noisy and unruly. One has to wait until they saunter to their balconies, so to speak, before one can clean their rooms. And then one has to wait until they tire of the view and return to their rooms before one can clean their balconies. And there is much cleaning to do, for the guests are as unhygienic as alcoholics. Each guest is very particular about his or her diet, constantly complains about the slowness of the service, and never, ever tips. To speak frankly, many are sexual deviants, either terribly repressed and subject to explosions of frenzied lasciviousness or openly depraved. In either case, regularly affronting management with gross outrages of free sex and incest. Are these the sorts of guests you would want to welcome to your inn? The Pondicherry Zoo was a source of some pleasure and many headaches for Mr. Santosh Patel, founder, owner, director, head of staff of 53, and my father. To me, it was paradise on earth. So that just gives you one glimpse. I'm going to try to get through this fairly quickly to give you an overview. His first introduction to God is as a Hindu. And he says it always has to be someone who first introduces you to God, and that first introduction really leaves a lasting impression. He writes, "We are all born like Catholics, aren't we? In limbo, without religion, until some figure introduces us to God. After that meeting, the matter ends for most of us. If there is a change, it is usually for the lesser rather than the greater. Many people seem to lose God along life's way. That was not my case. The figure in question for me was an older sister of mother's, of a more traditional mind, who brought me to a temple when I was a small baby. Auntie Rohini was delighted to meet her newborn nephew and thought she would include Mother Goddess in the delight. It will be his symbolic first outing, she said. It's a samskara, symbolic indeed. We were in Madurai. I was a fresh veteran of a 7-hour train journey. No matter. Off we went on this Hindu rite of passage, mother carrying me, auntie propelling her. I have no conscious memory of this first go-around in the temple, but some smell of incense, some play of light and shadow, some flame, some burst of color, something of the sultriness and mystery of the place must have stayed with me. A germ of religious exaltation, no bigger than a mustard seed, was sown in me and left to germinate. It has never stopped growing since that day." Okay. After that, he introduces us to his exploration of Christianity, which is really an interesting section, and I'd like to read more of it to you. It's very interesting to see what he finds offensive about Christianity. If you've read Kierkegaard, he talks about how offensive Christianity is, or how offensive Christ is to us, because the idea that God becomes a human being, we've taken it for granted. We've grown up hearing that. We kind of lose the shock value, or the side of it that's offensive. And that's what Pi struggles with this idea that God isn't just, you know, like the Hindu gods are quite powerful and they can really kick butt, but when they get into trouble, they can perform really quite awesome miracles. And so what is this about this God who suffers humiliation and death? What kind of God is that? And the priest, every time he comes up with another question like that, his response is love. And it goes back to the same story again and again and again. So maybe I'll pick this up near the end of their conversation here. I couldn't get him out of my head, talking about Jesus. still can't. I spent 3 solid days thinking about him. The more he bothered me, the less I could forget him. And the more I learned about him, the less I wanted to leave him. On our last day, a few hours before we were to leave Munnar, I hurried up the hill to the left. It strikes me now as a typical Christian scene. Christianity is a religion in a rush. Look at the world created in 7 days. Even on a symbolic level, that's creation in a frenzy. To one born in a religion where the battle for a single soul can be a relay race run over many centuries, with innumerable generations passing along the baton, the quick resolution of Christianity has a dizzying effect. If Hinduism flows placidly like the Ganges, then Christianity bustles like Toronto at rush hour. It is a religion as swift as a swallow, as urgent as an ambulance. It turns on a dime, expresses itself in the instant. In a moment, you are lost or saved. Christianity stretches back through the ages, but in essence, it exists only at one time, right now. I booted up that hill. Though Father Martin was not in, alas, his block was slid over. Thank God he was in. Short of breath, I said, "Father, I would like to be a Christian, please." He smiled. "You already are, Kasim, in your heart. Whoever meets Christ in good faith is a Christian. Here in Munnar, you met Christ." He patted me on the head. It was more of a thump, actually. His hand went boom, boom, boom on my head. I thought I would explode with joy. "When you come back, we'll have tea again, my son." "Yes, Father." It was a good smile he gave me, the smile of Christ. I entered the church without fear this time, for it was now my house too. I offered prayers to Christ, who is alive. Then I raced down the hill on the left and raced up the hill on the right to offer thanks to Lord Krishna for having put Jesus of Nazareth, whose humanity I found so compelling, in my way. So you can see how he mixes in his spirituality that he prays when he's in trial and tribulation. He prays out to Lord Krishna, Vishnu, and Shiva, Mary, and Jesus, save me. And he mingles them. But nonetheless, is definitely has a relationship with Jesus Christ. And he's 14 at this time. I forgot to mention that. I won't say much about his relationship or his discovery of Islam. I'll say a little bit about that a little bit more later. I'll just say that he runs into Mr. Kumar, who is a Muslim baker and Sufi mystic, as I mentioned. And Mr. Kumar is also a Hafiz, someone who has memorized the Quran. And so they begin to have conversations. And Mr. Kumar says things like, "If you take 2 steps towards God, he will run towards you." And he describes Islam as a religion, as a beautiful religion of brotherhood and devotion. All right. The last thing in part one that I won't mention is that the family decides that they're going to leave India. The business isn't doing so well in the zoo business, and so they decide to emigrate to Canada and take a number of their animals with them on a cargo ship that they're going to resell in various places in North America. So this is now the largest section of the book, is section 2, and that is called the Pacific Ocean. And this is where Pai Patel spends 227 days on a cargo, on a lifeboat with Richard Parker, which is the name of the 450-pound Bengal tiger. So let me just lead you up to that a little bit. The first sentence of this section is, "The ship sank." A huge metallic burp takes place in the cargo. It's a Japanese boat called Tsim Tsum, and no one survives. His family is entirely lost in the shipwreck, and every other human being besides Pai Patel, who manages to get on a life boat, and the lifeboat is quite large. It's about 26 feet long and 8 feet wide, so it's not just a little dinghy we're talking about. And he finds himself with a zebra with a broken leg, Richard Parker, the tiger, a hyena, and an orangutan. And very quickly, the hyena dispatches with the zebra and with the orangutan, and Richard Parker dispatches with the hyena. And Richard Parker is left alone with Pai Patel. And Pai has to decide what to do, and he goes through a variety of scenarios in his mind. His plans 1 to 6 are various ways to get rid, to kill Richard Parker, and he decides that none of them are very feasible. So in the end, he decides that the only way to survive is to tame the tiger. And by doing this, he manages to keep himself and the tiger alive. By many feats of ingenuity, especially by learning how to fish, he wasn't a vegetarian, but he learns how to fish out on the lifeboat. And there's also water stills and things like that for them to have water. And of course, God. He turns to God many times throughout his many day ordeal, and definitely relies on God and God's strength to get him through. Toward the end of his ordeal, he runs into this algae island, which I mentioned before, with the meerkats, which are kind of like, I don't know, little, what do they call the animals up at Holden Lake?
Marmots.
I kind of envision them like marmots, but smaller. Kind of little amiable little woodland animals. But they feed on, there are these freshwater ponds, and the fish from the sea come in, and that's their source of food, and also a source of food for Pai and the tiger. But he decides not to stay there because he discovers it's a carnivorous island. I won't go into that. But he decides he doesn't want to live out his days there, apart from any kind of human being. Better to try to find his own, or to die. So he sets out again, and eventually, after 227 days, he washes up on the shore of Mexico. And Richard Parker heads off into the jungle without even looking back. I'll just read their departure. This devastates Pai Patel. Because over this period of time, they have become quite attached. I let myself down the side. I was afraid to let go. Afraid that so close to deliverance, in 2 feet of water, I would drown. I looked ahead to see how far I had to go. The glance gave me one of my last images of Richard Parker. For at that precise moment, he jumped over me. I saw his body, so immeasurably vital, stretched in the air above me. A fleeting, furred rainbow. He landed in the water, his back legs splayed, his tail high, and from there, in a few hops, he reached the beach. He went to the left, his paws gouging the wet sand, but changed his mind and spun around. He passed directly in front of me on his way to the right. He didn't look at me. He ran 100 yards or so along the shore before turning in. His gait was clumsy and uncoordinated. He fell several times. At the edge of the jungle, he stopped. I was certain he would turn my way. He would look at me. He would flatten his ears. He would growl. In some such way, he would conclude our relationship. He did nothing of the sort. He only looked fixedly into the jungle. Then Richard Parker, companion of my torment, awful, fierce thing that kept me alive, moved forward and disappeared forever from my life. So this object of fear was also he recognized that this is the only way that he could stay alive, and it was his raison d'etre for living, was to have someone to care for, to provide for. He had to keep Richard Parker alive, otherwise he would be next. And I think also he says it kind of keeps his own despair at bay. It keeps him from thinking about the fact that he's completely alone and that he's lost his family. Okay, so that's the end of part two. Part three is quite short. Pai is now convalescing in an infirmary or hospital, I guess, in Mexico. And there he's visited by two Japanese investigators from the Japanese Ministry of Transport, who are trying to get the straight facts. They're trying to figure out what was the cause of this huge metallic burp that caused the Tsum-Tsum, the cargo ship, to sink within 20 minutes and losing all of its cargo. What really happened is their question. So Pai tells the story, the whole story that took the majority of the novel, and they don't believe him. So this hopefully won't confuse you too much, but there's a few different characters going back and forth here. The two Japanese investigators are Mr. Okamoto and Mr. Chiba. Okay, but it does say who's speaking, so hopefully you can follow. Pai Patel. So you didn't like my story, Mr. Okamoto. No, we liked it very much, didn't we, Atsuro? We will remember it for a long, long time. Mr. Chiba, we will. Silence. Mr. Okamoto, but for the purposes of our investigation, we would like to know what really happened. What really happened? Yes. So you want another story? No. We would like to know what really happened. Doesn't the telling of something always become a story? Perhaps in English. In Japanese, a story would have an element of invention in it. We don't want any invention. We want the straight facts, as you say in English. Isn't telling about something, using words, English or Japanese, already something of an invention? Isn't just looking upon this world already something of an invention? The world isn't just the way it is. It is how we understand it, no? And in understanding something, we bring something to it, no? Doesn't that make life a story? Ha 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 ha! You are very intelligent, Mr. Patel. Mr. Chiba. And then they speak in Japanese, but they have a different font. So Mr. Chiba in Japanese says, what is he talking about? and Mr. Okamoto says, I have no idea. Hi, Patel. You want words that reflect reality? Yes. Words that do not contradict reality? Exactly. But tigers don't contradict reality. Oh, please, no more tigers! And then he says, Pai Patel says, I know what you want. You want a story that won't surprise you, that will confirm what you already know, that won't make you see higher or further or differently. You want a flat story, an immobile story. You want a dry, yeastless factuality. You want a story without animals. Yes. Okay. So Pai then tells them another story. A story without animals. And it's basically parallels the story you've already heard with the tiger and the hyena and the orangutan and the zebra. But this time, let me see if I can get this straight. The zebra is a Japanese sailor with a broken leg. The hyena is the French cook who is a cannibal who decides to kill the Japanese sailor and eat him because he's desperate for food. The orangutan is Pai Patel's mother, who gets killed by the French cook. And what does that make Pai? Any guesses?
Richard Parker.
Richard Parker. So this is the dry, useless factuality story that's much less interesting. And then, after he's told the story, Pai has one other conversation that I want to share with you. Mr. Okamoto. Yes, that's it. Let's go. Well, Mr. Patel, I think we have all we need. We thank you very much for your cooperation. You've been very, very helpful. Pai Patel says, you're welcome. But before you go, I'd like to ask you something. Yes? The Tsim Tsung sank on July 2nd, 1977. Yes. And I arrived on the coast of Mexico, the sole human survivor of the Tsim Tsung, on February 14th, 1978. That's right. I told you two stories that account for the 227 days in between. Yes, you did. Neither explains the sinking of the Tsim Tsung. That's right. Neither makes a factual difference to you. That's true. You can't prove which story is true and which is not. You must take my word for it. I guess so. In both stories, says Pacatel, the ship sinks, my entire family dies, and I suffer. Yes, that's true. Pike continues, so tell me, since it makes no factual difference to you, and you can't prove the question either way, which story do you prefer? Which is the better story? The story with animals, or the story without animals? Mr. Okamoto, that's an interesting question. Mr. Chiba, the story with animals. Mr. Okamoto, yes, the story with animals is the better story. Mr. Pai Patel, thank you. And so it goes with God. Okay, so, yeah, just as the footnotes, when they write their final report up, for the entire, what might have happened when they have no conclusive evidence at all, either way. There is an interesting last paragraph that they tag on to their report. I might as well share that with you as well. As an aside, story of sole survivor, Mr. Pisin Molitar Patel, Indian citizen, is an astounding story of courage and endurance in the face of extraordinarily difficult and tragic circumstances. In the experience of this investigator, his story is unparalleled in the history of shipwrecks. Very few castaways can claim to have survived so long at sea as Mr. Patel, and none in the company of an adult Bengal tiger. So I guess my question to you is, which story do you prefer of the two stories that you heard? The story that is the straight facts, that he calls dry, useless factuality, but is probably the more believable story for many, or the story with the animals, or any other comments or observations that you'd like to bring in?
As I remember, it's been about 6 or 7 months since I read it, but as I recall, at the beginning of the story, Richard Parker is swimming toward him, and you don't know whether Richard Parker is a person. You're led to believe it's a person at first.
Okay.
For a while.
Mm-hmm. That's right. He got his name. I never mentioned that.
He's a tiger.
Switcher. Mix up his papers, right? Is it the trapper or his owner?
Yes.
Or?
Thirsty the trapper and Richard Parker the tiger. Whoops.
He switched names. That's what it sticks. But you're right. He... Mm-hmm. And he helps him onto, without thinking about it, he helps him onto the the lifeboat.
Which makes you think even more so that it's a person mm-hmm. rather than an animal at the beginning. Mm-hmm. And as I recall too, some other people on the ship helped him get into, or told him to get into the lifeboat, and then they started lowering it. And then the zebra comes bounding over the side of the boat, lands in the lifeboat, and that's how it breaks its leg.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I think also they push Pai into the boat, hoping that somehow that will get rid of the hyena.
Yeah.
I think they know that the hyena's in it too, because it ruins the lifeboat for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he realizes afterwards that they weren't just being so generous, but mm-hmm. there's, you know, go down there and you can be the fodder for the hyena, and then we can get on the boat afterwards.
Yeah. You read this, book here, Holden, this last winter, and had just an amazing conversation about the nature of story and what story is and what truth gets told in story that's actually a more profound and important truth, finally, than the truth that's involved in dry, yeastless factuality, you know. And when we would look back through the book, The Loop, about, you know, stories within stories, and just that idea of there being a little bit more, that a story offers us more. I mean, it almost seems a comment on fiction and what fiction gives to us. That's what we discussed. It was very, very intriguing.
So how do you understand truth?
Well, he kind of makes the point that any telling of any experience is going to be colored by your perception. And so it's almost impossible to tell a dry, yeastless story because there's always going to be some sort of coloring to it, you know, based on what you see and what you, you know, bring to it emotionally and spiritually.
Stories also don't stifle imagination.
Yeah, the role of the imagination, I think, is really important for him in terms of differentiating. Because there are many myths or narratives out there that we can choose from. I think I want to lead you into another example of this. He has two characters by the same name, Mr. Kumar and Mr. Kumar. And one is his biology teacher, and the atheist, socialist, atheist, socialist, and biologist, I guess, scientist. And the other is the Muslim baker and Sufi mystic. And there's a little scene. First, I guess I should try to give you a little bit of the worldview of Mr. Kumar. The biologist, come on. Okay. He is at the zoo, and this gives you his impression, how he sees his world, what narrative myth, which is science, he sees his world through. Mr. Kumar was the first avowed atheist I ever met. I discovered this not in the classroom, but at the zoo. He was a regular visitor who read the labels and descriptive notices in their entirety and approved of every animal he saw. Each to him was a triumph of logic and mechanics, and nature as a whole was an exceptionally fine illustration of science. To his ears, when an animal felt the urge to mate, it said Gregor Mendel, and recalling the father of genetics. And when it was time to show its mettle, Charles Darwin, the father of natural selection. And what we took to be bleating, grunting, hissing, snorting, roaring, growling, howling, chirping, and screeching were but the thick accents of foreigners. When Mr. Kumar visited the zoo, it was to take the pulse of the universe, and his stethoscopic mind always confirmed to him that everything was in order, that everything was order. He left the zoo feeling scientifically refreshed. So is it fair to say that science is a story, that it is a narrative, or it has its own myth? Hmm. I don't know. What do you think?
I thought Polly's father was rather tough, I guess would be the word, because he had all of his children at a young age going to the zoo and watch the lion devour an animal. I mean, this was quite a gross scene, really. But then some of the scenes on the boat with the hyena eating the zebra and things like this were very, very descriptive and gross to me.
I suppose you could think of that, sorry.
And that experience gives a plausibility to the animal story to me, because you see what grounds he has for treating Richard Parker so carefully and training him so thoroughly, and you know, you learn about being a super alpha and the super, super tiger who's in charge, and even Richard Parker thinks he's in charge. You know, that little beginning scene sets the stage to believe that one can train a Bengal tiger on a 25-foot boat.
Well, he couldn't tell his story without knowing the science, without knowing
right.
all of the habits and all that stuff that we assign to science about that tiger. It would have just been a fanciful story.
Right.
His story is plausible.
So it's not that reason and faith are mutually exclusive, is that?
Well, they have the same name.
Mr. Kumar and Mr.
Right.
Kumar.
Yeah,
that's right.
And that the rest of the book pulls those two together.
Yep. Okay, so where the two of them actually meet is one day they meet in the zoo. Let's see if I can find this. When they are looking at a zebra. And again, I think this tells you about the different worldviews, the different narrative stories that they live in, right? I had brought some carrots, says Pi is talking. There was one left, a large and sturdy specimen. I took it out of the bag. At that moment, I heard a slight scraping of gravel to my right. It was Mr. Kumar coming up the railing in his usual limping and rolling gait. Now, he's already with Mr. Kumar, the baker. So this is the other Mr. Kumar, the biologist, coming up. Hello, sir. Hello, Pi. He also calls him Pi, whereas the baker calls him Basin. Another hint. The baker, a shy but dignified man, nodded at the teacher, who nodded back. An alert zebra had noticed my carrot and had come up to the low fence. It twitched its ears and stamped the ground softly. I broke the carrot in two and gave one half to Mr. Kumar and one half to Mr. Kumar. Listen, tell you. Thank you, Pasin, says one. Thank you, Pi, said the other. Mr. Kumar went first, dipping his hand over the fence. The zebra's thick, strong black lips grasped the carrot eagerly. Mr. Kumar wouldn't let go. The zebra sank its teeth into the carrot and snapped it in two. It crunched loudly on the treat for a few seconds, then reached for the remaining piece, lips flowing over Mr. Kumar's fingertips. He released the carrot and touched the zebra's soft nose. It was Mr. Kumar's turn. He wasn't so demanding of the zebra. Once it had his half of the carrot between its lips, he let go. The lips hurriedly moved the carrot into the mouth. Mr. and Mr. Kumar looked delighted. A zebra, you say, said Mr. Kumar. That's right, I replied. It belongs to the same family as the ass and the horse. The Rolls Royce of equids, said Mr. Kumar. What a wondrous creature, said Mr. Kumar. This one's Grant's zebra, I said. Mr. Kumar said, Equius Burcelli Buemi. You can pronounce your Latin better. Mr. Kumar said, Allahu Akbar, God is great, in Arabic. I said, it's very pretty. He looked on. I don't know. So we have no hint there as to which Mr. Kumar is giving which carrot. Do you have any guesses as to which? He says one is more demanding with the carrot than the other. Do you want to take any guesses? There's no way of knowing. One kind of keeps the carrot as long as possible, and he tries to, like, you know, eventually kind of grabs it out of his teeth, and then the other one sort of lets him have it right away.
I would say that the scientist is the one who holds on to it, because science is a lot about controlling things that we often can't control and just trying to have a grasp on that, whereas the mystic is probably a lot more likely to let events happen as they will and then interpret them.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else want to agree or disagree? I think that makes a lot of sense. I noticed that on the third reading of that paragraph that maybe he's trying to say something, just even in the way they give the carrot to the animal. Are they trying to control it and observe it and how they take it, or are they just letting it go with the flow?
What about also the nervousness of, if we do place them in those two roles, the nervousness of the mystic, like, never really been around the zebra or
So it could have just been personality, right? And neither nothing to do with the plot. So it's possible that also we are bringing something about our biases about science, too,
right.
to that.
Yeah.
I noticed I did some of that with this book too, because I have some bias as seeing scientific narrative as the one that is dry, useless factuality. I'm not sure that that's actually what Jan Martel wants to say. So before we run out of time, I did make some photocopies and I want to pass these around. This is another key section of the book that I thought we could read together and reflect on.
Well, those are going around. What do you make of all the detail about the animals, which is very scientific, and their characteristics and their patterns and eating and all the rest, but about the religions, about the three religions, it's very generic and very general.
Any theories that you have?
Well, I didn't like that business about practicing the three religions because it didn't seem to me that it took any one of them seriously in their particularity. They were so
too generic?
Pale. Too generic.
But don't you think that's the way a lot of people view their religion? You know, just kind of generic, and I'm kind of this, and I do this, and I'll take what I like, and I won't do what I don't like, and I think it's pretty human.
Well, and that's why I agree with you, that I'm not sure the comment he's making is that science is useless practice.
Why not?
Well, because there's so much scientific detail. Mm-hmm. So much of the power of observation and the characteristics of animals. And I'm not a biologist, but I think a biologist would love this book.
Okay, sure.
For all that detail.
This book in the Holden bookstore right now that I just happened to flip through a little bit. It's on one of the shelves for the Holden lectures, like the people, whatever, the sessional profs can suggest books. And so I don't know the name of the person, but it's about science. And it talked in this one chapter about science as poetry. And they were saying that when you get down to talking about the atom, all language is poetry. You know, that all of our language is approximate. And it's what happens, though, I think, for some scientists, is perhaps they forget that language is poetry. And they reduce it to saying, this is just the facts. This is an interpretation. This isn't an understanding. This is just the way it is. And what happens is the subjective, or the viewer, drops out of the picture, and they think there's just, it's possible to have objective truth without any bringing anything to the situation.
Which makes it a hammer, but not an angle to do it.
Okay, go ahead.
I don't think that he does think science is dry factuality, because he's got the three levels of religious, atheist, and agnostic. And agnostic is the one he really has a problem with, because it's just living your life by means of doubt. And they never will settle on anything, and they're just constantly like taking in all the information and going over it again and again. And with atheism, at least you're concrete on something and you truly believe in it.
That's right. You're a careful reader. Okay, so let's look at that. The author said that chapters 21 and 22 are critical for the novel. So I thought we should just, they're short, so we could read them together. So if you see at the bottom of page 69 is chapter 21. And if I could have a couple of volunteers, one to read chapter 21, and then one to read chapter 22. And you can just start reading if you want to. And then we'll stop after chapter 21. Okay.
21. I'm sitting in the downtown cafe after thinking. I've just spent most of an afternoon with him. Our encounters always leave me weary of the glum contentment that characterizes my life. What were those words he used that struck me? Ah yes, dry, useless factuality, the better story. I take a pen and paper out and write. Words of divine consciousness, moral exaltation, lasting feelings of elevation, elation, and joy, a quickening of the moral sense which strikes one as more important than an intellectual understanding of things, an alignment of the universe along moral lines, not intellectual ones, a realization that the founding principle of existence is what we call love, which works itself out sometimes not clearly, not cleanly, not immediately, nonetheless ineluctably. I pause. What of God's silence? I think it over. I add. an intellect confounded, yet a trusting sense of presence and of ultimate purpose.
Okay, so help me out here. Can you try to make sense of what is going on in this indented, italicized list? I think it's only 10-2. Don't we have to 7?
But the Vespers starts at 7.
Starts at 7. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't realize that. I wasn't paying attention at announcements. Okay, just do we have one more minute then? Mm-hmm. Okay. What's happening in that italicized paragraph? What do you get the sense? What is he trying to describe?
Well, he feels like he's talking about religious experience, mm-hmm. to a degree. And that religious experience is not an intellectual experience, necessarily.
I think he's saying all experience is not intellectual.
Any other thoughts?
Well, it's the opposite of the glum contentment that characterizes my life. So maybe not all experience, but any kind of aware experience that we're having.
Yeah, it seems to kind of grasping for language to be able to try to describe spirituality, that existential leap of faith, like Kierkegaard talked about.
He was also a wandering guy. Yeah, you know, until the author was a pretty wandering guy, mm-hmm. taking odd jobs and sitting down.
I think it's also a way of describing the better story.
I think so too. Mm-hmm.
So, and then the better story is about love. Quickly, we'll read chapter 22, and this is the dry factuality and the agnostic that comes through here. So go ahead.
I can well imagine an atheist's last words. White, love, my God, and the deathbed leap of faith. Whereas the agnostic, if he stays true to his reasonable self, if he stays beholden to dry, useless factuality, might try to explain the warm light bathing him by saying, possibly a failing oxygenation of the brain. And to the very end, lack imagination, and this is a better story.
That's right. So you can have kind of reason that go along with your faith that can see the better story. And the atheist can also change one myth for another, it's possible. But the agnostic, who just reduces everything to biology, right, misses the better story. I didn't realize we're out of time, so I just have a little concluding few sentences I'd just like to read in summary. In terms of what I think this is trying to say to us, do not insist on a story that won't surprise you, that will confirm what you already know, that won't make you see higher or further or differently. Don't cling to dry, useless factuality, but use your imagination to see the possibilities that God is making present in your life, and be open to the juicy, surprising story of grace that will contradict all that you thought you knew and will take you places you never expected to go. Trust that the central event of existence is love, and that taking the leap of faith always makes for the better story. So thank you very much.